From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, could Dr. Larry Nassar be considering a guilty plea to charges of sexually assaulting athletes?
Things could still change, but generally, you don't schedule a plea hearing unless both sides are pretty sure that this is a strong possibility.
As the Catholic Church prepares to beatify Detroit priest Father Solanus Casey, we'll meet someone who knew him well.
I think of his humility first. I think of his wisdom second.
Biodiversity, even more powerful than we thought.
If biodiversity and our loss of biodiversity affects the production of biomass, it's going to affect people's ability to live.
And we will learn about falconry.
What keeps me in it is be able to work out in the field with a wild animal, knowing that that bird is high on the food chain and anything can happen.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later in the hour, Leopold Pokagan and his band of Potawatomi.
They did not want to leave Michigan. They did not want to leave the home of their ancestors and the home that they hoped would be the home of their children.
And how embracing Christianity helped them avoid relocation.
People left us alone, one, because we were Indians, and two, because we were Catholic Indians.
But first, it appears that former MSU sports doctor Larry Nassar is considering a guilty plea to charges he sexually assaulted young athletes. For the 100-plus women and girls allegedly abused by Nassar under the guise of treatment, they're learning that he may actually admit to it in court as early as next week. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells is with us now. So, Kate, what makes us think a plea deal could be shaping up?
So nothing is finalized at this point. Nothing's been signed or submitted into court and approved and all that. But this is officially on the docket in two different courts, one in Ingham County Court, where he's facing several first-degree sexual misconduct charges, and the other in Eaton County, where he's also facing similar charges. So these plea hearings are officially on the docket. They've been scheduled. Things could still change, but generally you don't schedule a plea hearing unless both sides are pretty sure that this is a strong possibility.
Interesting. And there are women ready to have their day in court and speak out.
Yeah, you know, I called one of them this morning just to kind of get her reaction, because this would be, as you mentioned, the first time that anybody would have heard Nassar say, yeah, I did this. You know, we know that he pleaded guilty to the child pornography charges, but he's always maintained his innocence and that this was a valid medical procedure. And so I spoke with one woman, Larissa Boyce, who was a teenager when she says she was abused. And she says that she also told her MSU coach at the time. Now she's, you know, a mom of four kids. I asked her, what is it like to think about that this could actually be real?
Hearing it come out of his mouth, saying that he wronged us girls, that takes it to a whole nother level.
So what could be the outcome here? Could Larry Nassar die in prison?
If you are Attorney General Bill Schuette and running for governor and prosecuting this case, you are sure going to do your darndest to make sure that that happens. His federal sentencing on the child porn charges are next month, December 7th. He has agreed in that plea deal to not fight a sentence of between 22 to about 26 years. The guy's in his early 50s. At some point, if you get a high enough prison sentence at the state level, that is essentially life in prison. You don't have any shot of getting out. And you also just look at how many criminal sexual conduct charges he has in the first degree for children under the age of 13, charges where the mandatory minimum sentencing is 25 years. And it certainly seems as if it's headed that way.
And we are certainly beginning to see kind of a head of steam pick up with even some very prominent names in the gymnastics world saying, yeah, me too.
Right. We saw Ali Raisman come out this past weekend on 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. And I think a really powerful one as well was Michaela Maroney a little while ago, not just because she said, hey, this happened to me too, but because she was willing to get involved with the criminal case as well. And you read details in the criminal case about what she alleges happened to her from Larry Nassar. And for me, it was some of the most disturbing allegations in this whole disturbing case.
How so?
That she, you know, she mentions in her tweets about this that at some point she was afraid for her life, that she believed she was drugged on the way to Tokyo for a team event and woke up in a hotel room where she says Larry Nassar was abusing her. So I can imagine that if I am Dr. Nassar's defense team, I would like to get a deal struck before I have that kind of testimony.
What does Larissa Boyce think about the chance of maybe looking him in the eye in court?
So that's the other interesting thing. That'll be another step after. Yes. Let's say, one, we got to get a plea.
Yep.
Figure
okay.
that out.
Yep.
And then two, sentencing is a different stage. And mm-hmm. that could be in 3 weeks. It could be in 2 months. And there will be likely an opportunity for victim impact statements. Of the 120-plus women who say that they were abused by Nassar, it will be interesting to see how, even just logistically, mm-hmm. it could take days for these victim impact statements. And for women like Larissa, this is something that they really want to do.
I know a lot of people wouldn't want to face him, but I'm at that point in my healing process that I want to. And I want to take my power back by facing him and saying, you did this to me.
Wow. Well, just to be clear, though, no details are in public because there is this gag order.
Gag order,
but
yeah.
We do know then Larry Nassar is on the docket for plea hearings in both Ingham and Eaton counties within the next couple of weeks. And you are keeping your eye on that as this all unfolds.
Thanks, Cindy.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. And if you miss any part of today's Stateside, you can easily find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and you can click on podcasts and you'll find the link. Drone technology is quickly becoming more sophisticated, more affordable. And while that may be great for people who want to find a drone under the Christmas tree, it's a nightmare for prison officials. Criminals are using drones to try to smuggle in drugs, cell phones, and other contraband. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports on how prisons are fighting back.
I'm standing with Chris Gouts of the Michigan Department of Corrections on a rural road in Ionia, Michigan. On one side is a small farm with a barn. On the other, the Handlin Correctional Facility. Gouts says two workers came into the yard of the facility early in the morning on August 17th and heard this sound. That's a drone.
When they went to go investigate, they saw the drone come down and drop a package of contraband near one of the housing units.
Inside the package, cell phones, cigarettes, marijuana, and razor blades. Now, the three men operating the drone weren't exactly criminal masterminds. They only used the drone's GPS and not the camera, so they couldn't see officers running pell-mell towards the package.
As the staff started to congregate, the drone came back and literally dropped another piece of contraband right near them.
That second package gave corrections officers and local police all the time they needed to nab the guys, who'd tried to hide the drone in the barn across the road. They're in jail, awaiting trial, and if they're found guilty, they'll be on the inside, not the outside, of this very prison. While their ineptitude may be humorous, Gout says every incident presents a potential threat.
We have to blow the siren, we have to bring every prisoner from outside, lock them in, do an emergency count. We have to go out. We have to sweep the yard.
Incidents like this are increasingly common. Drones have been spotted dropping contraband into prisons in more than a dozen states. Matt Scassero is director of the University of Maryland Unmanned Aircraft Test Site.
It's easy to do. It's hard to do well.
On the other hand, Scassero says, if you do know what you're doing, it's becoming easier to avoid getting caught. Drones now have such a long range. You don't have to be next to a prison to fly contraband to your buddy on the inside. You could be 20 miles away.
You could design a system that is totally autonomous, that you say go and shut down the RF link, and there's no transmission back and forth between the aircraft and the ground station.
As you'd expect, experts are working to stay one step ahead. Scassero says companies are designing audio, radar, and laser systems to detect drones, along with technology to disable or intercept them. The best solution would be to jam the radio frequencies that drones use. That could keep them completely out of a prison's airspace. But there are some big problems to overcome there. Jamming can interfere with the bandwidths used by other aircraft or communication systems, which is why it's hard to get special permission from the Federal Communications Commission to do it.
Our biggest concern is flying weapons in. You get a gun inside a facility, that's a nightmare.
That's Michael Ziegler. He's Deputy Secretary of Public Safety and Corrections in Maryland. His department just got emergency funding to evaluate drone detection systems after contraband got into some state prisons via drone. But Ziegler says there will be no easy fix here.
This game of drones is a game that constantly changes, and it continues to get more sophisticated as time goes on.
Maryland is expected to install drone detection systems in its prisons within a year or two. Experts say it likely won't be long before drone detection is a standard security feature at state and federal prisons all across the country.
That story from Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton. There is so much to talk about, so much to know about in this diverse state of ours. We can't possibly know it all. And that is where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you've got a question about Michigan, something or someone you've always wondered about, just send it along by going to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. Up next, some people hunt with guns, others hunt with birds.
You always got to take your hawk out when your hawk is hungry. Your hawk does not kill for the fun of it like what a cat would. If you take your hawk out and it isn't hungry, it'll sit up in that tree and watch you and it will not come down to you, no matter if I had that bird for 5 years.
We're going to learn about falconry and then the power of biodiversity.
If biodiversity and our loss of biodiversity affects the production of biomass, it's going to affect people's ability to live.
That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Firearm deer season begins today in Michigan. But as thousands of hunters head out grabbing their rifles, there is a very tiny group of Michiganders who hear this as they are out hunting small game. That is the sound of a red-tailed hawk, one of the species of raptor birds used in falconry, an ancient way of hunting. Right now, there are only about 100 falconers in Michigan, and one of them is here with us now. Chris Wysocki is a master falconer and a member of the Michigan Hawking Club. Chris, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Chris, what are the typical kinds of birds that you might use in falconry in Michigan?
Well, here in Michigan, probably because of the terrain, most falconers will probably fly a red-tailed hawk. Some of them fly goshawks, which is very few people get to see because it's a hawk of the woods. A few of the falconers fly cooper hawks, which there's a lot of them here in Michigan, but they're a very high-strung bird and very hard to use in falconry. But I would say most of us probably use red-tailed hawks because the game species here is rabbits and squirrels, and those are perfect for a red tail.
And are they wild or are they trained, Chris?
In falconry, they're trained, but we're allowed to trap them out of the wild. We have to go through a 2-year apprenticeship to be able to get a permit to trap a young red tail out of the wild. We have to take a test. This is through the DNR, and that's only half of it. The other half is that once you pass your test, you have to get yourself a sponsor. And to me, that's the hardest part because you basically have to sell yourself to another falconer to take you on for 2 years. And this other falconer has to be practicing the sport for at least 4 years or longer for them to take on an apprentice.
So it's very regulated and very carefully watched.
Yes, it's the most highly regulated hunting sport in the nation. And it's mainly because we're trapping live, unhurt raptors out of the wild.
And then how do you go about training a wild raptor to hunt for this small game for you?
Everything is positive reinforcement with food. You know, you don't yell at the hawk, you don't hit the hawk, or everything is all positive reinforcement.
And how long does that take? Does it depend on the bird?
It mainly depends on the bird, but I would say usually right from the trap, when we trap one, we can get it out flying and coming back to us within 4 weeks. It's very intense training for those birds to come back to you and work as a team. You have to hunt these guys 4 to 5 times a week. But if I get 6 days in a row that are nice and sunny out, I'll hunt that bird 6 days a week. A little bit different from gun hunters. You can't take your bird out once a week on a Saturday or Sunday and expect that bird to fly for you. It's going to be very difficult. These birds are used to being out in the wild. They're a wild bird. They don't imprint towards you. So that's what you have to do to be able to be successful in the sport.
Describe for us the actual hunting process. What is a typical hunting session like?
First of all, you got to do a little bit of homework. So do you know what rabbit habitat is? Do you know what squirrel habitat is? You got to have 7, 8, 9, 10 fields with that sort of habitat in there to take these birds out hunting. You can't go to the same field all the time. You know, the prey know this when you're out stomping around in the field day after day. They won't come out. So basically on a day like I'll be hunting today, go right around the same time, 3-4 o'clock, bring the bird in. I weigh the bird. You always got to take your hawk out when your hawk is hungry. Your hawk does not kill for the fun of it like what a cat would. If you take your hawk out and it isn't hungry, it'll sit up in that tree and watch you and it will not come down to you. No matter if I had that bird for 5 years, that bird would not come down to me if I threw it up into a tree while it was overweight. So I'd put her in a box that I have in my vehicle and I'll go out to my field and I'll release her. And then I'm out in the field with a stick trying to beat brush, trying to get rabbits out. If it's squirrels, I try to keep that squirrel up in the tree because the hawk has a better advantage of chasing a squirrel while it's up in the tree than with it being on the ground.
That stands to reason. How often do you actually catch something?
Usually, if you have an average bird, they'll catch something 33% of the time. The bird I'm flying now, this is my 8th red tail in 22 years, and she's one of the above average. She's been averaging right around 70%.
Wow.
We've been out, I think, 10 times today, and she's got 5 squirrels, something like that.
And the falconry season, I understand, started in September and runs through March, but most folks, falconers, wait until this time of the year to start hunting?
That's correct. Yep, and the reason is because of the tall brush and the leaves on the trees. And it's tough out here right now. I mean, as the year goes on, most of these red tails, their percentages will go up because the snow will knock down this brush and it makes it easier for the birds to catch a rabbit trying to go through 6 inches of snow or instead of, you know, no snow at all.
Chris, I'm wondering, is all of this good for the birds? I mean, I guess some people listening to us may feel that being caught and kept and trained by a human might be traumatic for the raptor. And I'm sure many are wondering if trapping and training these birds hurts the wild populations.
When we trap a young red tail out of the wild, those are the only ones we're allowed to trap. A red tail, their first year of their life, they have a brown tail. They already have proven data that out of all raptors, now this is all raptors, you know, eagles, red tails, falcons, 70 to 90% will die the first year. That's the way nature is. Or else they're not good hunters and they can't catch nothing and they starve to death. When we trap them out of the wild, work with them together, and we supply fields that have game in them where they can fine-tune their skills. That's why when we release them, they will be good hunters. Now, we take one of these brown-tailed red tails out of the wild, and we train it for 1 year, and we decide to release it. The chances of that bird surviving is 90%. completely the opposite. Now, in 22 years, I've flown 8 red tails. I release 7 back into the wild. I flew a couple of them for 1 year, a couple of them for 3 years, one for 5 years, one for 6 years. I mean, we even spend a couple hours a day on days we don't hunt. You know, we either sit with them, watch TV with them, just so they get used to all the people and to stay calm down. Come end of March when we can't hunt no more, we don't associate with them anymore. Within 3 to 4 weeks, they go revert right back to their wild state. They don't have nothing to do with me. They're afraid of me. It's just like I'm training a brand new bird again.
Huh. So which means that if they're kind of bouncing back, doing a reset, then you're saying they're able to adjust back to the wild once you release them.
Exactly. You know, a lot of people might think that, you know, they say, oh, you have a nice pet as a red tail. And I don't like to call it a pet because it's a wild animal. These birds do not personally like you. Most of them do not like being touched, you know, and they can leave anytime they want. But they decide to stay with us because if they don't catch nothing, they know at the end of the day, they're going to get rewarded by food that we have. That's the whole process. They trust us because they know they're going to get fed if they don't catch nothing.
Can you describe the feeling or the connection that you get when you're out and having a good day with your bird?
Be able to walk out in the woods, and most of these red tails will have bells on their feet when you're out hunting. It's mainly so you can hear them following you. And to be able to go out and know your bird is 50 feet up into a tree and following me along, and then I can bust a rabbit out and I see this bird do stuff that most people never get to see in the wild, you know, within 50 feet of myself. Seeing these birds crash through brush, through pricker bushes, wrap around trees, and most of the time they don't get hurt. They're built like a truck, and be able to see that. And then they catch a rabbit or squirrel, they let me go in there and dispatch that rabbit or squirrel that she'll hop up on my glove while I put that game in my game bag. You know, it's a high for me by doing that.
Chris Wysocki, Master Falconer. Thank you so much for talking with us, Chris.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate it.
Biodiversity. It's one of those scientific terms we hear and we think, oh yeah, that's a good thing, we need it, without truly knowing why that's so. Now a University of Michigan and Smithsonian study gives us the answer. Researchers found biodiversity is even more powerful and important than they thought it would be. Study co-author Brad Cardinale is with us. He's a University of Michigan ecologist. And your fellow researcher, Emmett Duffy from the Smithsonian, put it interestingly. He said, biodiversity is not just a pretty face. Why is that?
We found that biodiversity is important for sustaining humanity. One of the key points of this study is that biodiversity seems to control the production of biomass in most of the world's ecosystems. The production of biomass is simply living tissue. It's important because everything you eat, drink, and breathe is a function of the biomass that's produced in an ecosystem. So the more biomass we have in, let's say, a forest, the more wood we get, the more biomass is produced in our oceans, the more seafood you have available to eat. It also regulates things like flood protection and control from hurricanes. Biomass regulates the amount of oxygen that's produced for your air and the amount of carbon dioxide that's taken out for a livable climate. So if biodiversity and our loss of biodiversity affects the production of biomass, it's going to affect people's ability to live.
When we hear that word biodiversity, I think most of us sort of know what it means, but how do you define biodiversity?
I define it very simply. It's the variety of life. So imagine you go out to your favorite woodlot or forest. It's the variety of different tree species that you see. Some of that's obvious at the levels of species. You see elms, you see oaks, you see maples. Within those species, there is also a lot of genetic diversity that perhaps you don't see. And biodiversity is simply the sum of all of that variation that has come to be over the history of the Earth.
What were you going after with this study? What were you trying to figure out?
Since about 1990, there has been this hypothesis in the field of ecological sciences that the modern rates of species extinction, which are about 1,000 times faster than normal, is going to affect the productivity of ecosystems. And that hypothesis spawned about 500 different experiments where somebody somewhere has gone to a forest, has gone to a grassland, has gone to a lake, and manipulated at very small scales the diversity of species, let them run for a few years, and then looked at how much biomass could be yielded out of that study. Out of those 500 experiments, almost 90% of them have now shown that the more species you have, the more biomass you get. But the problem with experiments is that they're small scale, right? They're at the scale of a couple meter plots out in a field. They're in a greenhouse. They're in an aquarium in the lab. And they're not realistic. They intentionally control all of the other things that might affect productivity so that we could see if biodiversity matters. So skeptics have always argued that, well, you know, these experiments are kind of cute, but I sort of doubt that they'll actually happen in nature, that we'll see these effects of biodiversity because Mother Nature is much more variable. And there's a whole lot of other things out there. Sunlight,
the rough and wild,
biodiversity just won't matter has been the argument.
So you said to yourselves,
let's test that new hypothesis. So if people think biodiversity doesn't matter in the real world, let's get data from the real world. And let's statistically quantify these effects of biodiversity.
And so, my golly, you did, what, over 600,000 sampling locations from seven continents?
Yes. So we covered pretty much the entire planet. Ours was a data synthesis, so we took studies that were already published from these 600,000 locations. And these were researchers that had not only measured biodiversity in forests around the planet, in grasslands, lakes, oceans around the planet, but they had also measured the production of biomass of all these different organisms, as well as everything else that controls biomass production, like rainfall, temperature, nutrients.
So your job, it sounds like, was to take this enormous amount of data from all over and synthesize it into something that was cohesive, that could reflect the real world around the globe.
Exactly. These were not experiments. These were things that have been together, species been together for tens of thousands of years. They're in the real world where Mother Nature is fluctuating all the time. So this was the true test of whether biodiversity actually matters.
And what did you find?
We found that biodiversity matters, and it matters a whole lot more than we had expected. So not only did we see these effects of biodiversity on the productivity of every one of Earth's ecosystems that we looked at, we also found that it was more important than almost everything else that controls productivity of the planet. And that was the big surprise. It is more important than the things that control climate change, and more important than temperature, more important than things like carbon dioxide. It was more important than the nutrients that control a lot of productivity in the planet. And that was a real shock to us. It really suggests that biodiversity is one of the premier factors that influences how productive Earth is.
It's like nature's bedrock,
it seems. Yes.
And it also seems that when we, tell me if I'm wrong in kind of making this connection, when we feel as individuals that the effects of climate change are really beyond our control, when you can't get governments to agree and you feel like the doomsday clock is ticking, am I right in assuming that biodiversity can be our protector in this?
One thing that biodiversity seems to do, one of its roles, is an insurance policy. It is the insurance that essentially protects us from climate change. And as we lose it, we're going to reduce our ability to moderate a livable climate. As we lose it, we're going to reduce our insurance policy for flood control and protection. We're going to lose our ability to adapt to the new food sources we're going to need in the future as things change.
So agriculture, food production, climate change, famine, drought, it's all part of this biodiversity protection.
It is. And if you were to just go into your grocery store and count up the number of species that are required to produce your food, if you were to go into your local forest and the watershed and look at how many species are required to produce some drinkable water for you, I think you'd be really surprised at how quickly the numbers escalate into the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. And all of those things are required for us to survive prosperously.
What lessons do you hope we, mankind, takes away from this work you've done?
So people are very good about thinking of our physical infrastructure that's needed to keep humanity safe and prosperous. We're very good at making buildings and cities that are shelters. We're very good at engineering energy grids and transportation networks. I think the lesson from our study is that we need to start thinking about biological infrastructure, not just at physical infrastructure. Our lives depend on our ability to maintain a biological infrastructure on Earth that maintains our climate, that produces our food, that gives us protection from pests and disease. And as we lose biodiversity from the planet, we're going to lose that insurance policy. And we need to start protecting that biological infrastructure in the same way we protect our physical infrastructure.
What's the next question that's in your mind now based on this study?
The next question that comes to my mind is we have to figure out exactly what species to save and exactly how many. We know biodiversity is important, but we don't have enough time, we don't have enough people, and we do not have enough money to save everything. Some things are going to go extinct, and the estimate is that within our lifetime, by the time I die, about 30% of everything on this planet will be extinct. So my next job as a scientist is to start to figure out exactly which ones do we need to put our limited resources into saving that have the greatest impact on people.
Brad Cardinale, very interesting University of Michigan ecologist. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, remembering Father Solanus Casey.
I think of his humility first. I think of his wisdom second.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
When you're a leader, the decisions you make, for better or for worse, have lasting repercussions that echo into the future. And if you ask the descendants of Leopold Pokagan, they will testify that he made the right decisions. It's Wednesday, time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. With November being Native American History Month, we now welcome the director of the Michigan History Center, Sandra Clark. Hello, Sandra.
Hello.
Good to have you with us again. And Dr. John Lowe, who earned his PhD in American culture at the University of Michigan and is an enrolled citizen of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians. Currently, he's an assistant professor in comparative studies at Ohio State University, Newark, where he teaches history and American Indian studies. John, it's so good to have you with us.
Fantastic to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So we are going today to dig into the very interesting story of a Potawatomi leader named Leopold Pokagon. And John, before we get to Leopold's story, give us an idea of what life was like for the Potawatomi in Michigan in the early 1800s and how things were changing for them.
It was a period of a lot of stress and tension. The days of fur trading were falling apart. The conflicts with Europeans were occurring. The Potawatomi specifically had been involved with the Northwest Confederacy, Little Turtle and Blue Jacket, and had resisted continued movement of American settlers into the Great Lakes region. They'd also been involved, some of them, with the Battle of Fort Dearborn and Tecumseh's movement to define an Indian territory, an Indian country that would not be lost.
Where was the Potawatomi mainly living?
We were living along the St. Joseph River Valley in southwest Michigan and northwest Indiana.
As I read what the tribe called themselves, I just love that. Tell them what they called themselves and what that meant.
Well, we called ourselves the Potawatomi, which means keepers of the fire. We also called ourselves the Anishinaabe, which means the human beings. So Potawatomi, the oral history is that there were Jesuit priests that were canoeing down with Hurons, Indians canoeing them, past the lakeshore, Lake Michigan. And the priests asked the canoers, who are those people on the shore? And the Hurons thought, they're asking them, what are they doing? And they responded, they're tending the fire or they're keeping the fire. But it also represents our alliance, our confederacy with the Odawa, the Ottawa, the Ojibwe, and the Potawatomi, because we're the Three Fires Confederacy. And so we are the keepers of the fire. The Ojibwe are the keeper of the traditions, and the Odawa are the keepers of the trade.
Sandra, as white settlers kept pressing westward, this policy of removing the native people really kicked into high gear. So how were tribes in Michigan reacting?
Tribes I'd rather call them bands because we're really talking about small communities, but obviously reacting to it in very negative way in the sense that they did not want to leave Michigan. They did not want to leave the home of their ancestors and the home that they hoped would be the home of their children. And so they took a lot of actions to attempt to remain in Michigan. One group held a council around 1832 over on the west side of the state and considered their options and basically said, most important is that we stay here. There were some who, when things got too much pressure, left, went to Georgian Bay, Walpole Island, Canadian, British territory. So some chose that option. There wasn't a universal reaction, but a pretty universal idea that this was home and this was where they wanted to stay.
John, how did the Potawatomi fare in this removal process?
Well, it was a different experience depending upon which band you were a part of. In 1833, the United States government called the Potawatomi to the Chicago area for a final land cession treaty, essentially going to be a removal treaty of the Potawatomi. And so the bands from Wisconsin, the bands from Michigan, the bands from Indiana, Illinois, they came oftentimes under a sense of coercion and duress because they knew that if they didn't negotiate some kind of deal, they would get no deal at all. So they came to Chicago in 1833 and they negotiated with the United States government for what was to happen to them and their children in the future.
Ultimately, this led to something that is called the Potawatomi Trail of Death. Certainly people have heard of the Cherokee Trail of Tears. What happened there?
Yes, the Trail of Death begins essentially in Twin Lakes, south of Plymouth, Indiana, where Menominee's village, the state militia surrounded the Menominee's village under the pretext of organizing the people to come to the village church, and there was going to be a possible gift-giving or annuity. And instead, the militia surrounded the church and began to march the Potawatomi west, mostly by foot. As they went along through the rest of Indiana, through the rest of Illinois, they gathered up other Potawatomi. It was a very difficult process. At least 100 or more of the Potawatomi died along the way and were not given a chance generally to bury their dead, which was very egregious. And so they were marched out to Osawatomie, Kansas. But the Pokagon Potawatomi escaped that through that 1833 Treaty of Chicago when they negotiated a sidebar agreement.
Yes, and this is where the story of Leopold Pokagon really begins to develop. Tell us, how does his story begin, John?
Apparently he was not Potawatomi. He was Odawa or Ojibwe, probably. But he's captured by the Potawatomi and adopted into the Potawatomi tribe and is adopted by our then leader, Toponabee. So he becomes the adopted son of Toponabee. And when Toponabee passes in the 1820s, Leopold takes over leadership of the village, not because of any hereditary sort of sense, but because he was a charismatic and competent leader. So he then sought to negotiate a passage of how are the people going to stay in our ancestral lands. That was, as you mentioned earlier, of primary importance to many Potawatomi, not all, but many Potawatomi insisted that they wanted to stay where we walk on the bones of our ancestors, which is a compliment when we say that we have been here so long and our ancestors so plentiful that we walk on their bones. And so he negotiated an opportunity for Christian Potawatomi to not be removed. And he had, prior to the treaty, went to Detroit and implored upon the Detroit Diocese of the Catholic Church to provide a priest and renew the Catholic relationship with the Pokagon Potawatomi that probably had been in existence when the Jesuit priests had been here 100 years earlier, but had left as France was driven from the area.
So renewing those ties, Sandra, with the Catholic Church, what opportunities did that bring?
Well, that brings you the opportunity to be considered a civilized person. In the language of the day, native people who practiced their traditions were savages. And to be civilized, you had to be Christian. You had to educate your children, and that tie with the Catholic Church would also bring that opportunity for education. And you had to farm, be settled. And so this was a big step to demonstrate that you were not a threat. You were a citizen or acting like a citizen and therefore should be allowed to stay.
Which was the ultimate end game. John, was this a spiritual conversion or was this a political maneuver?
Well, I think it was a spiritual conversion that had significant, long-lasting political implications. I think it's interesting to note that Leopold Pokagan chose the Catholic faith, which, as we all know, in the 1820s, 1830s, was not the most popular Christian denomination to be a part of.
In the U.S., you're right.
Exactly. It was Catholic hysteria, and anti-papist feelings were quite strong. And so the Catholics generally were marginalized in the United States. And so I think Leopold, by choosing the Catholic faith, there's a bit of genius there in that he doubly insulated us. People left us alone, one, because we were Indians, and two, because we were Catholic Indians. And so they just stayed away from us. And as long as we didn't cause trouble, and as long as we tried to fit in, as long as we appeared to be assimilating, then people allowed us to stay.
How long did Leopold live?
Leopold passed 1841, but he lived long enough to use treaty monies that he'd gotten from a land cession in Indiana to purchase lands near what is now Dowagiac, Michigan, Silver Creek Township, which continues to be the epicenter of the Pokagon Potawatomi Nation today. Although our reservation, as he had envisioned it, was basically taken from us in the 1800s.
There's so many nuances, is there not, Sandra, to the way that this band was able to just kind of, maybe in a sense, work the system, but they got to stay and not get marched west.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Lowe, but they actually go to federal district court in Detroit to stop their removal.
You're correct that there was a movement to remove the Pokagon Potawatomi, and representatives of the Pokagon Potawatomi went to a state Supreme Court justice, Ephraim Ransom, and he issued an opinion that said that we could not be removed, that we had complied with the Treaty of 1833, and so we were not subject to removal. So yes, we did have to seek legal redress after we had been told we could stay here. Even afterwards, we had to pursue our rights and remedies to remain here.
That's Ohio State University history professor and Pokagon Band of Potawatomi citizen, Dr. John Lowe, and the director of the Michigan History Center, Sandra Clark. Thanks to both of you for sharing this very uniquely Michigan story of Leopold Pokagon.
It's been our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. This Saturday, some 70,000 people will pack Ford Field in Detroit. They'll witness a ceremony called Beatification. It will elevate a humble Capuchin priest to the title of Blessed. When Father Solanus Casey becomes Blessed Solanus this Saturday, he will then be one step away from being named a Catholic saint and perhaps becoming the first American-born priest to be called saint. Father Solanus served for decades as the porter or doorkeeper at the Capuchin Monastery on Detroit's east side. And that's how scores of people came to know him, to be there to tell him their troubles, ask for his blessing and his advice. Those who knew him are sharing their stories, including Sister Teresa Milne. She grew up near the Capuchin Monastery. Sister Teresa Milne is now marking her 70th year as a religious sister with the Sisters Servants of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, the IHMs. We spoke recently at the IHM Mother House in Monroe.
Well, when I was a little girl, our house was stationed in such a place on Van Dyke Avenue that it wasn't a long distance for us to walk to the monastery. My grandmother would often take me by the hand. I was the youngest, so I was the only one at home with her. And if she wanted to go to the monastery, she always took me with her. And we would walk to the monastery, and I'd sit down, and she would talk to Father Solanus and tell him what her concerns were. Then, as we were leaving, he always blessed me and put his hands on my head. And I was always thrilled by that. Well, then, as we grew older, my next in rank in the family, the second youngest, was my brother Douglas, who became attracted to the priests at the monastery. What we didn't know after he graduated was that I think he worked as a night watchman in a bowling alley or something. And on his way home, he used to stop at the monastery for the early mass. And I remember his coming home and saying, you know, Father took me inside the cloister at the monastery. And he said, I saw some of the brothers. Well, then, it was only 6 months later when he said, I'm going to enter the monastery and I'm going to be a brother. I just admire the life of a brother. It's humble. It's lowly. They do all the menial work in the monastery. At that time, that's what they did. And so going to visit him at the monastery, we got to know some of the other friars. And we always would go there to ask for special blessings.
Describe Father Solanus Casey.
I remember that he had a long, wispy beard, and that he had a kind of a squeaky voice, and that he also played the violin, but it was squeaky. And in the room, if you go there to the friary, and you see his room, his violin is standing in the corner. A lot of people didn't know that about Father Solanus. And I think that the friars used to just practice virtue when he played, because he didn't play it well.
What do you feel, Sister, was his charism, his gift? What was his greatest gift?
You mean
gift?
Father Solanus? Mm-hmm. That's hard to tell. I think of his humility first. I think of his wisdom second. And I think of his, well, when I said humility, I think of him as sort of fading into the background or trying to and not being able to. I remember one time my brother, who had charge of the kitchen, because he was a brother, said that Father Solanus was held up in the office by people who had come to talk to him, and supper was over. And he came over, and my brother said, I'll fix you something, Father Solanus. And he said, oh, no. And he went and got a stale crust of bread, and he put it under the faucet of cold water, and that's what he had for supper. And my brother also told me one other thing. He came down early to get everything set for breakfast, and he stopped in the chapel, and Father Solanus was prostrate on the floor in front of the altar. He had been there all night praying. So those are some memories that other people might not have or might not even know about at all.
And he always was there at the door for anyone in Detroit needed. Your brother succeeded him as the porter.
Yes.
Father Solanus certainly was there anytime anyone needed him.
That's right. And the place used to be packed. I can remember that even as a little girl. And here is something else that my brother told me. He said when the early 1900s, it was time for Father Solanus to make his final vows. I don't know how accurate this is, but this is what my brother told me. He said that they were going to send him home because he couldn't master German. And they spoke German in Milwaukee, and that's where the formation house was. And he couldn't master the German, so he couldn't take theology because it was taught in German. And because he couldn't, they were puzzled. They said, what will we do? He's a very holy man. And their solution was this, which a lot of people don't know. They decided to make him a simplex priest, which meant that he could say Mass, but he could not hear confessions, nor could he preach. But he did many times without knowing it, because that's what people did when they came to see him, tell him their troubles and problems and sins.
Does it stun you still to think that he's going to be blessed, that he's going to be...
Oh, I'm so excited, but I don't think I can be there because I'm not sure that I could handle Ford Field at age 94. But that's all right. I'll probably get a better view of it, and I remember him myself. And to think that I talked to him is exciting. It really is exciting.
And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.